This week on the show, Comcast and Level 3 use Netflix in their battle over the future of online video. WikiLeaks is a domain name on the lam, and Justin and Rihanna top Billboard's Social 50 chart, right here on This Week in Media, number 213. Hey everybody, welcome to This Week in Media. My name is Dane Golden from Hey.com, and I'm filling in for Alex Lindsay today as your host. Today we have some great stories and some great hosts. We have first Andy Beach, who's calling in from Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome, Andy, to the show.
Thanks, Dane. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's fun to be with you today. And tell us about your website.
Sure. So I actually have two out there. The Video Uprising is the newest site, and it's really just a place where I write and cover topics in the video industry around the delivery side of it, and I get to blog about the different trade shows and whatnot that I go to. And then I also have one that's connected to a book I wrote a couple years ago called Real World Video Compression. .com that's really the nuts and bolts of doing video encoding and compression. So it's a little more technical.
And you recently attended New TV Live and Streaming Media West, I think.
I did, yes. I was at both those shows in November.
And so we'll look for your insights today with that background. And we also have Steve Lettieri, who's calling in from New London, Connecticut. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Dane. Good to be here. Hey, Andy. How are you?
Good. Doing good, Steve. Thanks.
And Steve is known for Killomino.com, Storyforge.tv, and SciFinal.com. Please tell us about what you do, Steve.
Okay. Killomino is a visual effects design and animation firm. That's where we do fun stuff for other people like Hasbro. And Storyforge, we produce web series for online distribution, mostly in the sci-fi space, which led us to start the SciFinal site, which is becoming sort of a hub for indie sci-fi online. So good to be here.
Fantastic. Well, let's dive right into the show. We've got story number one. Web traffic spat over Netflix highlights new tensions. This is an ongoing story with a lot of permutations. Andy, I know you're pretty familiar with the details. What are the facts of the case? It seems like a legal case almost.
Yeah, really, it has kind of played out like an episode of Law and Order or something this week. It was pretty interesting, and it started about a week ago. Level 3 came out with this very odd public press release that said that Comcast was trying to hold them over a barrel and charge them a lot more money to deliver all the new content they were going to be delivering, because Level 3 recently won the Netflix account from Akamai, so they're going to be delivering the major portion of the video for Netflix. Well, this is so they said that Comcast is now trying to charge them a great deal more money than they were, and that's effectively breaking the way the internet works. And so it sort of raised these whole net neutrality issues and how dare Comcast do this. And then more and more information started leaking out and coming sort of over the next day or two. It really started coming out that really this was not a net neutrality battle. It was really a peering issue, and it was sort of almost a business as usual. Like, these are constant tiffs that go on between these large companies that share traffic over the internet. And really, Comcast was just trying to get Level 3 to pay the appropriate amount of money for the amount of content that they were trying to deliver over the network, is what it more or less came down to. But it was really played out in the public in a way that we normally don't get to see. So it was like my version of sports. Like, I feel like I'm not a sports guy, but like I was kind of glued to every article coming out about this last week, waiting for the next one to see what he said next or she said next.
And we usually don't hear a lot about the details of what are called peering relationships, not peer-to-peer, but peering. And right. That is evidently between these content delivery networks where they essentially say, if you send me a certain amount of bandwidth and I send you a certain amount of bandwidth or gigabits or whatever they're sending, we'll call it even, essentially.
Right, exactly. It's like sailing rights or passage rights or something from the old days, where they have their backbones of the internet, their major highways for the internet, and they sort of agree, look, I'm going to get to send you this amount, you're going to get to send me this amount. If it goes outside that range, you know, here's the price that you have to pay. Now, the difference here and the argument became that level three, as one of these backbones, had a much better deal than they had as being a content delivery network. So as an ISP, they paid a certain rate because they were always going to – their ratio was never going to fall out of balance that far. Mm-hmm. But as a CDN, and particularly as Netflix CDN, who, as we know from the stats last month, is at times as much as a fifth of the traffic on the internet in
peak
the U.S.
Peak times.
Yeah. Right, peak
which,
times.
Which, so, what is that? What do you think that means? Does that mean that – people are watching it mostly in the evening, and that is peak time?
I think peak time might be our new prime time, in fact. I think if you really think about it that way, yeah, it is when people are watching this the most. So it's probably that rolling time zone kind of situation. But as level three transitions and becomes more and more of a CDN for Netflix, they're going to have a disproportionate amount of content and a disproportionate amount of traffic that gets delivered over Comcast. And so Comcast really wanted them to pay at the rate that was appropriate for the CDNs, which they did not want to do, obviously. So,
Steve Letieri, this story really hit a nerve both among people who like to watch a lot of online content and those providers as well, small and large providers of content. You're a content provider, and I know you use Roku, which people can get on Comcast or whatever their service is. I use Comcast. How do you feel about – is this a part of a bigger story, or did it just hit a nerve because of the players?
Well, I guess when you first start hearing, you know, the sort of the net neutrality flags going up, you know, as a content provider, distributor, you want to make sure that – your shows, if they're being distributed online, are accessible by everyone, you know, equally compared to everybody else's show. But I am an avid Netflix streaming user via my Roku box. So, you know, obviously, you know, when I started hearing this story, I'm like, well, you know, hopefully this doesn't disrupt my, you know, watching, catching up on, Dexter episodes or whatever on Roku or, anything like that. So, it just seemed like as you started to dig deeper and deeper into this, it was a little bit more like level three was kind of doing a bit of an end run around these sort of traditional peerage arrangements. And I think partly it may be because they, you know, possibly underbid their Netflix contract to win it away from Akamai. And then, you know, we're hoping to sort of kind of, you know, tiptoe by Comcast, and Comcast didn't let that happen. So, I think as was mentioned, sort of the thing that made this a little unusual was sort of the public way that this was discussed.
Right. It's we usually don't hear this type of dirty laundry, in fact, and so we don't have a lot of perspective on it. But it appears to me that this is as we find out more facts, it's sort of like two friends used to meet every Friday after work for a burger and a beer. And now one of them brings his girlfriend. They both have lobster and three bottles of wine, and they still want to split the tab.
Right.
Exactly, yeah.
Or maybe not such good friends anymore. But these are people that are still going to have to do business with each other because of the nature of the networks. Somewhat related story is that Netflix is now made a deal with a movie distributor called Film District. Now, this seems like a company that puts about 8 to 12 major releases out a year. Distributor, including next year, they're going to come out with Drive and Lockout. The deal says that they're going to send traffic to Netflix, and this seems to be in competition, and we're seeing a lot of disagreement among guys like HBO, where they're saying this is doing an end around our whole business model. I know that there was another deal that Netflix made recently to have first run films, but only 28 days after, was it the DVD release or the?
Yeah, I believe it's the DVD release.
Yep.
So these distributors are trying to preserve their current model, at least for a period. But the ball is rolling really fast on this. Andy Beach, what are your thoughts on where this is going?
Well, I think, it just goes back to what an interesting time we're seeing here as we transition from sort of traditional ways of delivering on-demand content into these new media ways. And we've seen the technology blossom for a number of years, and now we're seeing the business angles. And I had to laugh recently because I started seeing commercials where they're really touting that whole 28-day window. I can't remember exactly who the commercial was. But I realized that, like, really they were just calling out the fact that they had it 28 days before Netflix had it, you know, and they were being blatant about saying that, you know, Netflix is their competition and that they're feeling the pressure. And so they're using anything they can in order to fight that. And so we're seeing it come down, like we're getting past the point where the technology was somewhat of the problem of getting the content there. Like, there's enough of an audience online now, and now it's really down to having to be competitive around features and other elements that come into it. So I'm all for it. Like, I love being able to get my content online, and I want to see 100 of these different ways of getting content to my laptop and my phone and my iPad, so that they'll all blossom and we'll find absolutely the right one to make it work.
Steve Lettieri, I still go to my DVR and my cable rundown to see what's live before I go to Netflix streaming or any other streaming on Roku. That's at my lean back couch. What do you do first?
It's definitely a hybrid. I think just quickly going back to the commercials or whatever, you guys might have noticed Blockbuster's been really blatant about this, sort of, you know, equating waiting for the 28 days for a DVD from
Netflix to going to the dentist. Right. Yeah, that's exactly, you know, it. Yep.
Where the guy goes under and then the dentist walks away and says, I'll see you in 28 days.
Right.
Which is kind of, you know, smacks of desperation on Blockbuster's part. I think everyone knows about their troubles.
Oh, totally. Yep.
So, I don't think I'd seen a Blockbuster commercial in years. I almost forgot about them other than driving by.
Yeah, and that's even getting harder to even see them driving by. I noticed, you know, locally here, there's definitely a number of stores have closed over the last year or so. So it's, you know, the last days of Blockbuster are coming, I think. But in terms of, you know, how I watch content, I haven't yet cut the cord on cable, although I sort of, you know, consider it on a month-to-month basis. But, you know, I think I have a small a kid at home who, still likes, Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon, and some of these shows just aren't available in the streaming options. But, so I do watch, you know, use the DVR and on-demand service from Comcast at home, you know, use the streaming options through my Roku box or, using Netflix or, you know, rent movies on Amazon or what have you. But, so it's sort of a variety of things. But, I think it's pretty cool that, you know, that companies are able to make these deals with Netflix directly. I think most of, you know, what you see from the folks like HBO and others that are sort of resisting making these deals or putting up these sort of, you know, arbitrary, time windows of waiting 28 days or whatever, you know, I think in the end it's just going to hurt them in the minds of the consumer, because I know it annoys me when I see or hear about a new DVD release that isn't available on Netflix for an extra 28 days. You know, I'm more than happy to wait and support.
When was the last time you watched a Netflix DVD?
I do still do a good bit of that, but mostly with stuff for my son. So I think we watched Space Chimps 2 the other day.
That was a tearjerker, I have to tell you.
Yeah, it was a tearjerker, all right, not for the reasons that... But, so I still do a bit of that, but, generally I'm watching, streaming stuff, you know, whether it's through on demand or I don't watch a lot of appointment TV anymore, other than say like, you know, catching the Patriots Jets game last night on ESPN.
Now, from Space Chimps 2 to another great media producer, Justin Bieber, Billboard finally launches a chart based on social networking stats, the Social 50 chart, which apparently creates some sort of metric based on your YouTube, Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and I Like followers to determine who's got the most new followers and the most overall followers, with Rihanna and Justin are at the top. Finally, we can have these statistics. How will this affect your music choices?
I think it's safe to say it's not going to affect mine.
Yeah.
I mean, I basically know who Bieber is simply because he's in the social media news. And I wish I knew less about him than I did sometimes. But
Steve, do you think this has anything to do with who's more popular or better selling music?
Well, I think, you know, if you look into the music business a little bit there, you know, the money that artists make these days doesn't necessarily, you know, a majority of it doesn't necessarily come from the album or single sales anymore. It's sort of that whole music experience that a fan might have, where it's, you know, going to the live shows, buying merchandise, you know, finding these other ways to you know, for the artist to kind of connect and monetize the relationship with the fan. So, you know, I think this provides kind of an interesting insight into, you know, the artists that might be, you know, potentially making the most money because they have this certain level of popularity. You know, it'd be interesting to see how this equates to actual, you know, say iTunes download numbers, you know, in the sales chart side of things. But
and Justin Bieber was prevented last week from uploading his own video to his own YouTube site.
Right. Now, I think this was actually the more interesting story to me.
Sure.
He got bitten by basically the record labels, and I know he blamed YouTube, but it was the record labels that put in these copy block requirements, he was blocked from posting his own content on YouTube, and he's now broken up with YouTube.
So I think he's gotten back together since this story first came out, but the tweet was, "Yo YouTube, how you gonna block my own song?" So, so Universal Music Group and folks like Viacom and others had been really, really on YouTube for posting copyrighted content. So they installed the system where it automatically filters and determines who has rights to a particular song or audio or content piece, and then. So that he got bitten by that and said, "Hey, it's your fault." And YouTube says, "Listen, this is, we love you, but this is between you and your label."
Right.
And yet he, of course, was a YouTube-made sensation.
Yep.
Yeah, doesn't he have the number one viewed video of all time, I think?
Is that true?
Yeah,
well, I know he did for a long time. I know it was bouncing back and forth between him and Lady Gaga, I think. But I feel like that they're the other big battle out there, other than Level 3 and Comcast.
They're the only two with over a billion views.
Right.
I'm glad that finally Justin Bieber and YouTube have made amends, and it's a lesson to us all that we all just need to get along.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think this. There was some discussion about the music and the videos and things that, on the last episode of TWIM, which, you know, I find it interesting that any of these record labels would resist putting up the videos on the site when you can easily have links created to, you know, places like Amazon or iTunes for people to buy the music.
Well, it really is. It's down to the individual record label, the rights holder. The deal that YouTube has with them is that the system's set up where they can automatically block it. They can either automatically choose to monetize and have some ad ride along the video, or they can just do nothing. And so you know, Universal has it set up where they just automatically block it. And so that's what caught this. They could have easily had it set up where they just made money off of it through ad relations, but that's not what happened.
And there's another story that continues to evolve. You guys might have heard about this thing called WikiLeaks. Most people yes. haven't heard about it. And the latest with the WikiLeaks up to this morning, we're recording on Tuesday morning, was the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, I think his name's pronounced. He's under arrest, actually, on charges stemming from accusations in Sweden. But going deeper into the overall parts of the story, one of them is having to forcing them to change their web address, and in fact, not in our stories this morning, but also MasterCard and PayPal have also cut them off. But back to the DNS issue, there's a DNS host, or rather a registrar, that cut them off. And now their site itself is having to go across. It's being attacked, and we don't know. It's a very interesting concept to think about who might be attacking the host and registrar. Steve Lettieri, what are your thoughts about having to be on the run with going and sleeping at a new couch every night and hosting at a new ISP every night?
Yeah, it's that's certainly not something I'd want to do for our businesses. But you know, obviously the WikiLeaks stuff is playing in a completely different arena than we are with certainly with our Zerk's Log, you know, sci-fi content. Mm-hmm. But it's you know, you're dealing with you know, sensitive material for you know the United States and other countries, and the sort of the diplomatic relations that are occurring, you know, at pretty high levels and behind closed doors, and you know, it's certainly, you know, an issue that is beyond sort of the normal day-to-day stuff that we deal with. So, it's interesting. I could see where you know a host would you know not want to have a site like this. You know, from a business point of view, they don't you know. This is a site that you know has been getting you know cyber attacks, and you know it leads to a lot of hard feelings at a political level for you know between relations between countries. So you know you can see where a company would want to sort of distance itself from a WikiLeaks. You know, I'm glad we're not having to deal with that.
They've set up a number of different domains that have WikiLeaks in them. One of them is .ch, which is, I think, a Swiss URL, but it's hosted on French servers. I think, Andy, I'd like to ask your thoughts on what if this was happening to another, we could call WikiLeaks a publisher, legal or not.
Right.
What if it was another publisher that was like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Fox News, and they portrayed a certain type of viewpoint or ran one particular story and then were attacked with these DDoS, distributed denial of service attacks, from an unknown source? Would we feel it differently about it?
Well, I think that's really the problem here is, you know, someone may not agree with what they're doing, but I think they definitely are, you know, there was a great, I think the article was on GigaOM last week that really said in the title, you know, like it or not, WikiLeaks is a media entity. They are a publisher. There was even a quote in there from a professor, Jay Rosen, that said that they're really sort of the world's first stateless news organization. And so if you know, by attacking them, we're really setting a bar that allows for governments to interfere with freedom of press in a way that I'm uncomfortable in getting involved with. You know, I want the New York Times and these other places to have the ability to go do what they want to do. And therefore WikiLeaks needs to have the ability too. And I might not agree with everything they're doing, but at the same time, I want them to have the space to be able to go out there and do it without necessarily being attacked.
The media company Revision 3, I think it was 3 years ago, no, 2 years ago, was attacked by a DDoS, had a DDoS attack. I can't remember the exact details, but it was they had some information on a torrent, and then when they took the information off a torrent, an organization working for a copyright company attacked them. And, you know, they're not necessarily talking about stuff about the Pentagon, but yet, you know, that is a media company, and I think it demonstrates that we're all subject to these types of attacks from unknown sources, and there's not a heck of a lot we can do about it, and except, I guess, dump that domain. But that, if you want to get a media company dumped from their host, I guess this is one way to do it. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I agree with Andy that we, you know, agree or not, or disagree with sort of the politics behind some of this stuff. We definitely, you know, I would be supportive of the sort of free speech components to this story, you know, that, you know, WikiLeaks should be able to report the stories as they see fit. But, yeah, I mean, obviously we would not want to face this kind of thing ourselves. And, you know, what would you do? What would be your recourse to deal with something like this, you know?
Steve, do you feel that in a world where secrets, whether governments of any type, can be leaked like this, or for that matter, what if someone hacked into Gmail and decided to publish all Gmail or a domain of a company? Do you feel that this will start to change how people communicate digitally?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously we all need to be sort of, you know, careful with where and how we publish, you know, potentially personal or private material. You know, obviously the WikiLeaks type stuff should, you know, raise a big, big warning red flag for, you know, the governments of the world and security organizations to, you know, deal better with, you know, the safety and security of material like this. So, you know, in some ways it's good that, you know, these types of things happen on occasion for everyone to kind of reassess their protocols and processes and whatnot and do what they can to strengthen the security and things. But yeah, it's, you know, we live in this sort of big open digital world now with Facebook and Twitter and everything else. So, you know, pretty much everything is out there nowadays. And so it's definitely, you know, we're living in a different world now than we were, you know, say 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Now the FCC has provided new net neutrality guidelines, and there's going to be a vote coming up on the 21st, right before, at a meeting right before Christmas, which I always think of the dates right before Christmas or Wednesday before Thanksgiving as the date the government releases information they don't want anybody to report on.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like the dumping ground for you know, hiding a story.
So when this story is dumped, there's a very interesting article in PCMag.com about whether the changes and let me highlight the main points here. More usage-based pricing coming soon, question mark. Network management, okay, but no specific blocking. Wireless remains. It all goes back to Comcast. No reclassification, and Congress still in the mix in theory. Now, there's a vast number of competing priorities and legal precedents, one of which, of course, is the ruling, I believe in April of last year, that the FCC does in federal court, that the FCC doesn't have standing on broadband to a degree. Andy, what are your thoughts on what we've seen so far come out of this? FCC Chairman Julius Janikowski said, and so forth. What are the main points here?
Well, I think, you know, this one's a really tough one. When you start getting involved, when you have sort of big businesses and particularly technologies, and I feel like, you know, the government does need to have a slight amount of oversight here in terms of how businesses deal with this stuff. But at the same time, you don't want it to go too far. And the big concern is governments never really understand bleeding edge technologies. Like, I feel like that's something that they sometimes just don't get. So it's concerning. This is, I guess, better than some of the things that I've seen come out. But at the same time, it's not the right mix of how the neutrality issue needs to come out.
What's missing? Well, it sounds like you're saying that the government needs to keep a.
It's almost like they need to keep big businesses honest about how they do it, for sure, and then they need to be hands off the rest of the way. You know, beyond making sure Comcast or some company like that doesn't block content outright that they shouldn't. That's an absolute. But there does need to be a way to, you know, I feel like there does need to be a way to prioritize certain data over the others. You know, for example, I don't care if my email gets to me a few seconds later than my video packets. I would much rather my video packets were prioritized in such a way that they got to me. The thing is, all video packets have to be prioritized. You can't just prioritize the Comcast packets over the Netflix packets or something else.
Which gets back to our earlier story. Why that was such a hot point is because people are very sensitive to Comcast buying NBC and prioritizing only Comcast traffic, and Netflix is slower or poorer quality.
Right, and that should definitely bring, you know, something like that. If that were proven out, that's exactly the kind of thing that the FCC needs to be able to step in and make sure that the Comcast is not involved in, because that's starting to get very monopolistic. The usage price of who is going to pay for this, you know, the data. And ultimately, you know, unfortunately, us as the consumers are always going to end up brunting a lot of it. But there's got to be a better way to solve this issue, because you know, I find those frustrations myself. I'm a Comcast customer, and I've hit that cap issue several times. It's actually easy to do once you start consuming. You know, once you have I have a couple Roku.
You've hit the 250 gigabyte cap for the month.
Oh yeah.
What happened at that point? What happened at that point?
So nothing happened the first couple of times. I noticed it, and then I did get an email that was sort of a veiled warning that was sort of along the lines of, just to let you know, you're in dangerous territory here. and it was at that point, like,
Beware. Right,
exactly. And to be honest, you know, I was in a position where I work from home, I work in technology. I knew that I was likely going to even get worse at some point. So I ended up switching to a business account, which doesn't have a cap on it. Because
with
I work
Comcast,
out,
oh, with Comcast,
with Comcast, right? So I had to make the cap go away, and I'm having to pay, you know, a premium for that privilege. But I was in a situation where I had to do it, because, you know, there are times when, you know, I still do favors for friends where I consult on video files, and those are giant files. I move big files around all the time, and I don't want to run into this cap issue. It scares the heck out of me.
Steve Lettieri, who is your provider, and have you hit a cap?
I have Comcast at home. Have not hit a cap that I'm aware of. You know, I do the same sort of, you know, big transfer of video files for work, but you know, have a work or, you know, a business account for our internet in New London with a company called Metrocast, which is more of a smaller local cable company. I actually wish we had some other choices in the internet providers that we have, because the speeds are not all that blazing.
That's, of course, something that's not covered in any of this, is giving choice to the consumer. There's regional monopolies, and if you want a cable speed, you have one choice in almost every market.
Yeah, it's a real it's a pain in the butt, you know, to speak frankly. You know, we wish we had some other options. Unfortunately, we don't. You know, we could potentially, you know, spend a lot more money and move up a level on, you know, the different levels of the business accounts, but you know we're sort of a startup, and you know, we can't necessarily afford doubling our internet costs, you know, on a monthly basis. So it's a challenge. But yeah, I mean, you know, obviously we, you know, I think we all agree that we don't want our content treated any differently than anyone else's when it's being transferred around. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see if at some point in the future we as consumers could make that choice in terms of, you know, check the boxes, you know, prioritize your, how you want your internet content to be handled, you know, like Andy said, give me my, you know, video files first and then, you know,
Would you rather be able to use your washing machine or your shower? Pick one.
I know, right? So, you know, they say they don't want to treat the internet yet as sort of a regulated utility, but, you know, it seems like we may get to that point sometime soon.
One of the other key points in here was the wireless bandwidth, and quoted in Janikowski said last year, quote, "It doesn't make sense to have one internet when your laptop is plugged into a wall and another when access the internet through a wireless modem." I think that almost all consumers can agree there that as we go towards more phones and tablets, and I use a 3G modem, even when I'm at Starbucks, I have the perception that it's somehow more secure. I don't know if that is true, but I use it for that reason. And does it make any sense to regulate those differently? And the proposal seems to say no, regulate them in the same way. Are you guys big 3G users other than your for your laptop?
Yeah, I have the 3G iPad, and I use it pretty extensively. I have found actually that a lot of the public networks at points, like particularly like airports, there'll be so many people connected that it's actually faster to drop off and just use my own 3G at times.
Yeah.
You know, it's been so frustrating that it's just been easier to leave the Wi-Fi off unless I'm grabbing a really big file of some sort.
Do you ever do it for security reasons? Is that ever a concern to you?
I am a little more conscious about things like my financial records over Wi-Fi networks for sure, and I do like the slightly more anonymous feel of the 3G for that. I wouldn't say that's forefront for me. For me, it's usually reliability and connectivity. It's not the security issue that's the big one.
Because I'm very frequently at Starbucks, and I'm an AT&T iPhone user, and they say, oh, well, you're going to have this cap on your AT&T bandwidth of 200 megabytes a month or whatever it is, and then they'll say, but you can get all this free Wi-Fi at any Starbucks you go to. So I realize anytime I'm near a Starbucks, which in San Francisco is almost all the time, suddenly I'm connected to their network. And right. I was like, there's something missing from the security equation here. Why should I trust anytime I'm near a Starbucks that I am safe? That I'm missing something there. But that's not really a media question, but it is a bandwidth question. So I guess I'm the only one that has on this panel that concern.
I think I probably just gave up that concern years ago. Like, I feel like anything we do on the computer, I assume that someone has a way. There is someone smarter and more clever than me that if they really wanted to see it, they would find it. And there's very little I could do to stop that. So I just have to make sure I'm conscious of that when I share it.
Yeah, I agree.
The iPad is quickly becoming TV's second screen, says LostRemote.com. There are a number of apps that are coming out from different providers that are either making it into a really sophisticated remote or companion or streaming entirely or some combination of them. There's Hulu, Netflix, TiVo, Comcast now has a new app, and these are often both on the iPad and iPhone. I have not, not an Android user, and I'm not familiar with if those are coming out as well. But how are you guys using your tablets and phone with your television?
Well, I don't have an iPad yet. It is the number one item on my Christmas list, and we hope to get one in the office here soon also. But I do use my, you know, my iPhone quite a bit when watching TV. I guess, you know, a lot of it is like sort of, hey, I'm watching a show. Who's that guy in that show? What did he do before? Why do I know
him? I'm always on IMDb, always.
Yeah, right. IMDb, exactly. So, you know, I do a lot of that, I think, sort of, you know, supplemental searching for information that, you know, relates to whatever the show is that I'm watching.
I was just watching Remember the Titans, and I said, wait, that little girl, isn't she the one from Heroes?
Yep,
and
yep.
Sure enough, she was. So.
Yep. Yeah, like watching The Walking Dead, you know, it's like, hey, this guy, you know, the star of it used was in Love Actually. You know, he's actually English. Whoa, that's weird, you know. He's playing a Southern guy, you know.
There's a new app, I believe, for an ABC show that's an accompaniment app. And when you have the app on and you're watching the television show, there are certain audio cues that the app responds to and provides you with new information at a certain time. And that is an, although it's a somewhat of a cheesy app, that is an interesting approach to cueing people in interacting in a way that I haven't heard about.
Yeah, well, especially since a lot of, you know, viewers are watching shows, you know, on their own schedule. So, you know, you can't just say, okay, turn on your app at 8 o'clock because the show is on. You know, having that way to coordinate and sync up, I think, is pretty interesting. And,
right.
You know, you probably will see more of that.
I think you said it best earlier, Steve. You called it appointment viewing, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I mean,
sure.
I watch on my own schedule pretty much all the time now, other than, you know, say, like a live sporting event.
Right. I will say I have actually used that Comcast app both on the iPhone and the iPad, and it is great because one of the biggest complaints I've had about – I was a TiVo user for a number of years, got very used to using its interface – had to switch back to a Comcast DVR just for the sheer fact that, you know, technology fought me. They could never get the cable cards to quite work quite correctly once I moved to Portland with my configuration. So after 3 months I gave up, went with the Comcast DVR, and I hate the interface for searching and the guide.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It makes my eyes bleed to set things up. So I use exclusively, if I want to find something online, if I hear about a show, I go look it up on the Comcast app, and then I set all of my recordings because you can record individual shows and series through that. And so that's what I use to now program my DVR, and I never have to look at that guide again, which is great. It's actually made me watch more content on Comcast than I probably had in the past month that's been available.
It sounds like the equating it to the upgrade that I made from a Motorola Razr to an iPhone when I got that. It just takes away, it stops being a torture device and is actually an enabler of utility.
Right.
Yeah,
totally.
I have downloaded that Comcast app, but haven't played with it. But based on what Andy has said, I am certainly going to look to do that same thing, because I've had that same bleeding eye pain from the searching and such.
Absolutely. And what's nice is even if you're on another network, you don't have to be there to control it or to set things up. So, like, if I'm out with friends and someone mentions a show, I can literally just look it right up on my phone and set a timer to record it from there. And then it's just on the box when it appears. And I'd actually gotten used to being able to do that with TiVo to a certain degree through a web setup that they had. So it had never been on the phone or the iPad, but I could do that with TiVo before, and so getting that functionality back for me was great. But yeah, I mean, I work in the world of video. I love being able to watch video on the go and anywhere. So I use Hulu Plus, I use Netflix. I've even got the ABC and the PBS apps that are great ways to view content. I use the Twit app on the iPad and the iPhone to be able to stream shows from that network while I'm traveling around. And then I even have one called Zumocast that's a free one that I use to stream content from my own house. So I have a bunch of content on a server there that's running a piece of free software.
Wow.
And I'm able to stream that adaptively basically anywhere in the world that I'm traveling. So if I can't get anything else to work, like I travel internationally a lot because I work for a company based in Canada. And of course, when I'm there, can't watch Hulu Plus, can't watch Netflix, but I can always dial up my own home media server and find a TV show or a movie that has been recorded that I can watch from there.
I can tell you one feature, and of course, TiVo has a new app that's come out recently too, but I can tell one feature that I'm excited to use once I actually fiddle with the Comcast app. I just downloaded it. But the Xfinity app, excuse me. I even tweeted Comcast Cares just because I was so frustrated with this one time. I just am tired of scrolling through 1,000 channels and not remembering if I have a channel or not. There's no way of selecting it out. But apparently this app allows you to create an easier interface where you don't have to look at channels you don't actually get.
Yeah, there's definitely I guess that's true. And the one that I like is actually that you can filter really easily on it. Like the problem – part of the problem with an old style guide is that you do find yourself scrolling through thousands of channels, it feels like. And because I have a HD at my house, I've got the HD and the SD versions, and being able to selectively filter out to just get the channels I want or a subset of channels so that I'm really just looking at the content I want, it cuts the signal to noise ratio down dramatically.
The old Comcast, yeah. I'm going to stick by that, is the Motorola Razr of interfaces. One last story, Google Groupon acquisition and then disacquisition. the article says that that this could benefit digital out-of-home media. I'm not a Groupon user. Could not understand why it was worth $5 billion, $6 billion. Any thoughts on this? You guys have any expertise on this?
Very tangential on Groupon. Really. I mean, I've used it once or twice. My wife is really into it, and really.
Why does she? Why does she use it?
I think she's kind of. I feel like she's maybe always shopping in her head a little, and so she'll see something that, oh, that sounds like a really good deal to her, and she's willing to go ahead and buy it because she knows in the next X amount of months or weeks that she's gonna get something. Whereas I'm much more last minute about it, and maybe that's just the difference between how men and women think about shopping, but until I think about needing something, I probably haven't preemptively bought a coupon or something for it. So I never necessarily see the value of the deals as much. So it's not surprising to me that Google would want it. The $5 billion is probably a little to me a little surprising.
And then they didn't buy it.
And I think I feel like Groupon's probably playing that up because I think, you know, that's probably a really cool list of companies. Like, that gives them a certain level of cred. There's plenty of other – or there's a very small group of companies that Google hasn't bought that have gone on to do big things. Facebook is sort of one of the big examples there. They were offered like $1 billion at some point, and that turned out to be a really good deal for them. So I'm sure Groupon's trying to sort of play on that idea and that legend a little bit to keep pushing their value up.
Could this – this article says that it could be – good for people who produce media at home. Is there something that's similar to how AdWords works where we as media creators could say, oh, well, we're just going to have, instead of an AdWord account, we have a Groupon account. You sell something locally, makes me a few bucks. You see any relevance there?
That's a tough sell to me. It almost sounds like a different business model than what they are. Really, to me, it seems like Groupon is primarily around physical goods being sold digitally. So selling media or digital goods is really different.
Yeah, the sort of the daily deal thing is, I mean, I could see where, you know, people in a local neighborhood, if you know, the companies and businesses in a town or city or whatever, you know, kind of work together and are participating in this kind of thing where it might make some sense. It seems like this could tie in somehow maybe with, you know, sort of the geolocation type things, like with Foursquare or something, where, you know, I find it you know, interesting to see where these things are going, where if, you know, you check in when you get to a town and then you're sort of, you know, coupons start arriving into your inbox or whatever, you know, saying, hey, come grab a dinner here, 2-for-1, or, you know, free tickets to this show or whatever.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea. I'm sure it's already in progress somewhere. But I don't know. It's kind of, you know, it's hard to imagine turning down a $5 to $6 billion offer from Google if you're any company. So it's interesting to see if there's maybe some other things going on, you know, in the background here that we're not aware of.
And we'll find out more about that soon, I'm sure. Looks like we're at the end of the show. I'd like to remind our listeners to become a friend of TWIM on the Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/pages/thisweekinmedia. Of course, you can subscribe to This Week in Media on iTunes, and we'll encourage that as well. Andy, where can we find you online?
So the best places to find me is thevideouprising.com or realworldvideocompression.com. And if you want to tag along on Twitter, I'm Andy Beach.
Thank you. And Steve, where can people find you?
I can be found on Twitter, Steve Lettieri. It's STEVELETTIERI. KillerMinnow.com, StoryForge.tv, and SciFinal.com.
And if you're looking for me, Dane Golden, you can find me at Hey.com or just search for Hey on Google. And Dane Golden on Twitter. This message you've been listening to was recorded on December 7th, 2010. We are over and out.